Today's experiment is the synthesis of benzocaine. This is a mechanism you should be very, very familiar with at this point because it is a classic Fischer esterification. We have two main starting materials, para-aminobenzoic acid. And then ethanol as a solvent, but also a reagent. You have sulfuric acid that you're using as an acid catalyst. You reflux it for half an hour or so, and you end up with the ethyl ester. Which this is benzocaine for its common name, para-aminobenzoic acid. So benzocaine may be the common name. Its slightly more technical name then would be ethyl para-aminobenzoate. This is a solid. But I think that the para-aminobenzoic acid is also a solid. So there is a portion of the procedure that does tell you that you might need to reflux longer or heat longer if you cannot get all the starting materials to dissolve. We will be doing the whole experiment half quantity, but if you end up with a situation where you've got a container full of solid, no liquid whatsoever, add some more ethanol. Realize that ethanol is one of the reagents, so if we keep adding more and more ethanol, we're going to drive the reaction even more towards products, so there's no harm in adding excess ethanol. Once you're done with the reaction, you don't have much in the way of workup. You do a single wash, don't you? What is the wash with? What is that in words? Sodium carbonate. If it's not HCO3, if it's just CO, it's sodium carbonate. What do you think the sodium carbonate is used for? Neutralize acid, but two forms, because we have sulfuric acid as a catalyst, which will certainly neutralize that, but we also have the original starting material. Let's suppose the esterification is not 100% successful. The ester is not acidic. And so if you use carbonate, you'll neutralize the original starting material, which will become aqueous soluble since it's now a salt, and you can remove it out of the mixture. So the carbonate wash is used to neutralize excess sulfuric acid as well as unreacted starting material. Once you do the wash, you then are supposed to just collect by vacuum filtration the product, aren't you? And then you're supposed to wash the crystals with ice cold water. This morning the ice machine was not working, so cold water should work okay with the wash. Part of the reason we want to reduce the amount of water used is to reduce the possibility that some small amount of the product might be dissolved as you wash it. If you get all the way to the end and all you have time left for is to do that wash, just wait till next time and we can hope that the ice machine is working. It does say to do a recrystallization, correct? Don't. We've done enough recrystallizations. Because what we could do to be more time efficient is why don't we just, and I know you're going to cringe when I say this, but it's still better than a recrystallization. Why don't we just take a melting point to assess purity? Ooh, wow, that was a nasty look. Maybe you'd rather do a recrystallization. But no, we're not. If we're going to characterize, let's do a melting point, and then you'll need to do a solid ion. No, you may not test the benzocaine. Because some of you may be familiar with the fact that it's used as an analgesic, a contact analgesic, which means put it in your tongue goes numb. But consider this, that aside from whatever toxicity the compound itself may or may not have, you are non-PhD chemists in a non-pharmaceutical lab using non-pharmaceutical grade chemicals, doing no substantive purification of your product once you make it. It might seem then that you might have a few contaminants, that would be why you'd not want to test your benzocaine. I'm just saying this because some people see the cane and think, ooh, goody, but no. Also, if I hadn't made this mention before, and so where are my new people? This section doesn't have any more, right? I guess so. Well, some people move sections too, but the ethanol, even though it says absolute ethanol, that's supposed to be a pure form of ethanol that doesn't have water in it, but it's still going to have toxins in it, because otherwise you'd have a bunch of undergrads and grads all over the place that are trying to nip into the alcohol, yes. So they do it on purpose so that it's not consumable, but that actually has a secondary effect that actually is one of the larger reasons why it's done. Because if you can't drink it, you can't tax it. And so the ethanol that's sold to labs is way, way cheaper than you can ever get in a store, even if it's the same compound, because here you can't drink it, so it's not taxable. So, easy synthesis, shake and bake. Add everything together, heat it up. I would recommend using the air reflux columns instead of the water because it's a short enough time. Ethanol has a boiling point of 78 degrees, so you don't want to overheat. Just heat it up enough where you are actually getting reflux, which means you do have to have some boiling. Boiling doesn't mean that the whole thing is boiling, just so that you can see vapor rising and recondensing. That's about it for the procedure. Are there any procedure questions? Yes?
There's some versions at 0.5 milliliters of ton. They should have somewhere to reduce it to 0.3.
Actually, yes, because we're doing half quantities, so 0.5 turned into 0.3. Sure, why not? A little extra acid catalyst won't hurt it. Although, we are going to get to a discussion at some point about amines, so I want to point out that this product is mildly basic. I say mildly basic because the lone pair of that nitrogen, which is what usually is the basic portion of it, is in heavy conjugation with the benzene ring. Just like in amides, the lone pair is in heavy conjugation with the carbonyl. If the lone pair is busy, preoccupied with the benzene ring, less able to be a base. And so this is not as basic as some other amines. But it reminds me of another question. Why are we using carbonate in order to do the wash? Why not something like sodium hydroxide if we want to neutralize? Why not even bicarbonate?
Because the carbonate will react with the H+ and form ammonic acid, which will decompose as CO2 and water.
If you take carbonate and react it with acid, all you get is CO2 and water. And if you have anything left over, you just have carbonate, which is not going to saponify. Right? If we have a non-aqueous solution and we have carbonate, carbonate won't attack a carbonyl, so you don't have any problems with possible saponification. Now, at room temperature, if you just shake an ester with sodium hydroxide, it's generally unlikely, especially if you don't have a concentrated solution, it's generally unlikely that you're going to get saponification by brief contact, but we're still trying to minimize it. Let me write that in as a note, because it seems like the type of thing I'd ask on a lab quiz. Now, I believe we have 3 days scheduled for this lab, but we're going to finish much more quickly than that. Whatever extra time we have is going to give us a chance to finally come back and talk about lab reports, which, no, I'm not going to talk about lab reports today because, as you can see to the right of the board, once I pull the screen up, we have some sample problems that I want you to work. Because in lecture, we took reagents and I left the product blank, and you had to figure out what the product is. These are problems in which you have the product and have to figure out what the reagents would have been. Now, when you see these problems, some of them will say one molecule and then product. Some of them will say two molecules and then product. That means what it sounds like, that if there's only one molecule, somehow that molecule all by itself, when introduced to the right reagent, is going to make the product that I've indicated. If I say two molecules, that means you have to somehow make that product using two completely separate sources of carbon. There's one of the reactions over there. I don't tell you how many molecules to use. That's for you to figure out based on the type of product it is. There's one example reaction where I say malonic ester synthesis. So you have to approach that synthesis. Now, I need to actually give you a new first problem because I showed you this section, one of the problems already in lecture. So before you start attacking those, let me come up with a new problem number one. But once you've got your reflux set up and you've got that half hour, you're essentially just waiting. Be time efficient, work on these problems, because we'll go over the answers to the problems at the end of the lab today. Before I do let you go, though, I wanted to make tell you a brief story about benzocaine, because benzocaine does have an effect on the nervous system. And at the end of the quarter, when we've gone over a little bit of more biochemistry, I'm hoping to have a brief lecture to get a little bit into the operation of the nervous system. Now, some of you might be familiar with how nerve signals are transmitted because you've been taking bio courses. Could somebody very briefly tell me what is, for non-biology people, what is roughly the shape of a nerve cell and how do two nerve cells communicate? Anybody able to answer that? Okay?
Basically, nerves are the longest cells.
Okay? Okay?
They're a nucleus, or their central, kind of central system, central cell plant, is big, and they have hair like structures, which is the body of the cell.
Okay? So if I wanted to simplify, I might draw something that looks like this. Very, 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 very rough representation.
Yeah.
I mean, we could get into detail, say that's an astrocyte, that there's the myelin or whatever it's called, the phospholipid layer that is the sheath of this kind of nerve cell that we'll actually get into those classes of compounds later in the quarter, which is partly why I'm mentioning it. But then there's another nerve cell, right, that's next to it? Right. So coming back to what Leela said at first, how does an electrical signal get generated? Because nerve signals are electrical signals. To generate that electrical signal, you have to create a potential, a difference in charge. the desire of electrons to flow, which that makes the signal. The way that the body does that, or one of the ways it can do it, is by moving sodium or potassium ions, which have a certain fixed size, and they pass very carefully through these things called sodium channels, or I can't remember, this is where I break down in bio. I don't remember if sodium potassium flow through the same channels. They are different channels because they're different ion sizes, right? Sodium, I think, is the more frequently used one. Okay, so what happens is, for example, sodium ions can flow into a channel or flow out of a channel. If you make an imbalance of the ions, you generate a charge, which that's that signal that gets sent along the nerve cell. Well, what if you block the sodium channel? That's what benzocaine does. In other words, it prevents an electrical signal being generated. So if you could take a knife and, you know, it's not that the cell doesn't get damaged, it's just once it fires, it gets stuck in that position. So, like, you can say, ah, and the ch never comes because the electrical signal never resets. It's like a circuit breaker that's tripped on or off, depending on how you want to tell that story. Eventually, that compound breaks down in the body. The sodium channel is able to open up again. And so any of you that have ever had dental work that get the Novocaine or shots like that, those sodium channels get blocked. They stay blocked for a while until the compound decomposes. As it slowly decomposes, that's when you start feeling things tingling and the pain slowly start to come back again because the electrical signals can finally flow. So the pain mitigating action of the various canes, lidocaine, benzocaine, cocaine, they all operate in the pain-killing sense as sodium channel blockers. This is not bio class, but let me just very briefly write this down since I took the time to say it. Electrical signals in nerve cells can be generated by the movement of sodium ions through channels in the cell membrane. But, you know, if biology classes can talk this much chemistry, they say the word ester, for example, then I can say the word sodium channel once or twice, right? As long as I say them correctly. Now, since section one is hearing the sanitized version of this, I'll just make them smile by letting them remember that I was so flustered this morning that I couldn't even spell the word channel. I'm so darn dependent on spell checkers these days. Even I, as a native English speaker, L-E-E-L, I'm getting tripped up on these days. Okay, so electrical signals are generated by the movement of ions. Benzocaine blocks the sodium channel, preventing the circuit, you could say, from being reset. Yes? Yes, I most certainly can. So, benzocaine blocks the sodium channels, preventing the circuit from resetting, which means no ion flow, preventing the generation of a signal, which in this case we're talking about pain. Now you notice that in my horrible drawing of two nerve cells, I have this gap, the synapse that Leela was talking about. At that synapse, what goes on? Well, it's not that we have a spark that crosses that gap. We have a chemical message that is sent across that gap using what are called neurotransmitters. Did I say something bio-related? Yes, neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are chemicals that activate a reception site on what's called a receptor. That only acknowledges the presence of that chemical if there's a good enough physical or chemical fit. Well, there's quite a broad variety of receptors. There are nicotinamide receptors, which are sensitive to nicotine, which those kinds of receptors are found in muscles throughout the body, which is why nicotine is so addictive. It's not just, not just smoking itself that's addictive, but it's the fact that it's used as a neurotransmitter throughout the body. That if you start ingesting extra, your body gets used to it. When you stop, it says, hey, what'd you do with that? And that's why people get hooked on cigarettes. Besides those, there are opioid receptors, which are often exploited for pain. So morphine and compounds like that are used on those circuits. You have serotonin-related receptors, which that's one of the biggies. That regulates mood, sleep, eating patterns, the sort of rhythms of life, that system. If you mess with that, it causes all kinds of strange effects. There are amphetamine receptors, cannabinoid receptors. There's several series of receptors in the body. The different kinds of neurotransmitters can have what's called an agonist or an antagonist effect. In other words, it activates that system or it deactivates that system. And once we get a chance to cover a few more classes of biological compounds, we may revisit this topic of neurotransmitters, and I'll give a little mini lecture giving a little bit more detail about them, because that aspect of chemistry, the effect of chemicals on the nervous system, was one of a topic of interest of mine back in grad school. That and phytochemistry, the chemistry of plants, the different fragrances and smells and things that plants give. So just a little bit of information about benzocaine, not on a lab exam, but, you know, since many of you are in the biofield, I figure I should start talking a language that might be more interesting to you than protonate, open attack, deprotonate. Questions? So set up your refluxes. Please, 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 since other people are still going to be working in the lab, even if you're done and you're just working on these problems, have your goggles on. Again, towards the end of class, we'll regroup and go over the answers to these problems. Our set of reverse synthesis, trying to identify what our starting materials would be. So I did already show you this problem in lecture, but I'll take a little more time to describe it here. Our first problem did say take just one molecule and somehow make this unsaturated bicyclic ketone. So the point of this problem was to be able to recognize that it would likely be the product of an aldol condensation. Why? Because we do have that alpha-beta unsaturation to a carbonyl. That's the classic way to recognize that we have an aldol condensation. Once we recognize that we have an aldol, how do we back up? That's the part that we haven't done a lot of. Well, remember that all of these alpha reactions happen through an alpha position. The carbonyl that ends up in the product is the carbonyl that used to be part of the enolate. And so that means specifically, where I've indicated there, that is the alpha position that reacts. Where does it react, or how does it react? It attacks another carbonyl, which is what ends up at the beta position. When it first gets attacked, you could end up with an alcohol. That's the beta hydroxy ketone or aldehyde. But then it could dehydrate, which is how we end up with the alpha beta unsaturated ketone or aldehyde. So what you do is simply cut through the carbon-carbon double bond, open it up. The alpha side of it, that's just going to be empty because that's where the hydrogen was. The beta side of it, that's where the carbonyl goes. And so that means the correct answer would be this. Which is a bit odd way to draw it, but I've done it this way so I can keep the ring in the same orientation. Questions about this first problem? Yeah?
If we put the carbonyl on the top where you write beta, what carbonyl?
If I wrote the carbonyl pointed that way, that would be an improperly written structure, but it's the right idea. The other way that this might sometimes be written is like this. That way the carbonyls could be written more naturally, and the ring written more naturally as well. We still would have... Let's make sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 members of that ring. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Other questions about that first one? Okay, then the second problem. You were told that you needed to specifically take two molecules. And somehow produce, yet again, an unsaturated cyclic compound. Well, if we've made a cyclic compound, it's a Robinson annulation. How can we figure that out? Well, the most obvious thing that looks like it happened was an aldol condensation again. So let's do the same thing that we did up above. Break apart the aldol. Remember that it's the carbonyl that survived that was the enolate. It's going to be the alpha position of that enolate that reacted. And the position that got attacked was a carbonyl. But now look at the relative position of both of those carbonyls. Alpha, beta, gamma, delta. We have a delta carbonyl-carbonyl compound, which means that this could have been the product of a Michael addition. But it turns out we have two choices in a theory about how we could have broken this molecule apart to have been made by a Michael addition. To figure that out, we're going to break a bond at the alpha-beta position. We could do it from the alpha-beta position for the top carbonyl, or we could take the opposite perspective. We could say that the bottom compound, maybe for this first step, is the portion of the compound that did make the carbonyl. So relative to the bottom carbonyl, we could also cut between the alpha and beta bonds. So here are our two versions of that. Do what I said first about cutting the top, and that will get us acetone. plus. This unsaturated aldehyde. If I cut the other bond instead, then I get propanol plus an unsaturated ketone, which my instinct would tell me that second way might be the better way in real life, because you would have a more easily formed enolate. Right, the enolate would more likely form from the aldehyde, even if both were in solution, but then we have the conjugated ketone that could be attacked. Squishier ion liking to react with squishier ion. So, this part was aldol, this part was the Michael. And again, an aldol plus a Michael gives us Robinson. Questions? Okay, next problem we had, oh yes. You weren't told how many molecules. You were just shown a product. So this is a beta-keto ester, which means what kind of reaction was likely here? Oh, no, no, no. Simple, simple. Claisen. So watch out for two carbonyls near each other like that. Now it has to be a beta carbonyl. It can't just be any two carbonyl compound. How do we pull this apart? Retrosynthetically? Well, you know that it's the alpha position of one ester that attacks the carbonyl of the other. The alpha position then is directly connected to the next carbonyl, and the carbonyl that gets attacked is the one that does not end up as the ester. Because the whole point of a Claisen condensation is the alpha proton attacks, opens up the carbonyl collapses, and kicks something out. So on this particular example, it is... Wow. Whoa. Oh, but I circled just a little bit too much there. Oh, good grief. Does anybody have whiteout again? Oh, sorry. Good throw, bad catch, yes. If it were a frisbee, I'd be okay. No, there's a reason I teach and don't play sports, but
don't ever play baseball with me if you don't want nothing broken.
Okay, so there's the part that was an ester that was attacked. So when we pull this apart, we're going to have two esters, which of course is what goes into a Claisen condensation. But here's one point. The overall product is an ethyl ester. So to prevent any kind of transesterification, when you pull it apart, both the portion that stays an ester And both the portion that was an ester must both be ethyl esters. Questions about that problem? Okay, the next one was the monic ester synthesis, wasn't it?
Yes.
So both in your textbook and in lecture, we only saw monoalkylation by using the malonic ester synthesis. That is because there is a little bit of complication if and when you wanted to do a second alkylation. Since your text doesn't even bother going there, and at this late date, we won't either. Therefore, any of the problems you see here related to malonic ester synthesis, all of your products are going to be modified acetic acids. Because if you remember, the malonic ester itself is two carbonyls separated by one carbon. One of the carbonyls leaves because of decarboxylation. So if you have one carbon and a carbonyl that's an acid, that's acetic acid. So if you're going to be making a functionalized acetic acid, then the other carbons here are going to be from an alkyl halide or sulfonate that could have been used during the reaction. So we'll start out with diethyl malonate. First, we react with base. Since malonate is an acidic enough compound, we could get away with using ethoxide. Why ethoxide? Well, because you avoid any kinds of trans esterification. Theoretically, if we had any base, theoretically, that we carefully added to this compound, as long as the base was strong enough, you should be able to avoid trans esterification if that proton really is acidic, again, compared to the base. To be safe, we use ethoxide. Once you deprotonate, you alkylate. Since we found how many carbons we need in our alkyl halide, just stick a halogen onto the end of it. And this is primary, which is what we need, and so it can be attacked. SN2 occurs. Afterwards, we can saponify. Saponification would be better because we do have a double bond, and if you prolongly expose that double bond to acid and water, theoretically you could hydrate it. So to help prevent that, saponification would be a better route. Of course, if you saponify, you end up with a salt. In order to decarboxylate, we then need to put it back at least under slightly acidic conditions. So without water, if I just show acid and heat, no water, then we can avoid hydrating the alkene, we reprotonate the salt, and we get decarboxylation. Questions on that problem? Okay, two more. Next one, you're told that some kind of ketone reacts in order to make a carboxylic acid. That is the haloform reaction. Haloform takes a methyl ketone.
It first turns it into salt. And then on reacidification, we get the carboxylic acid. Then final problem, two molecules reacting to make this part aldehyde, part ketone. Now, if we look at this, we see it as a delta carbonyl compound, and that's again the signature of a Michael addition. We again, therefore, have two ways we can chop this up. And again, we would break the bond at the alpha beta position to go backwards to the starting materials. So on the left-hand side, I could break the alpha-beta bond there. On the right-hand side, I could break the alpha-beta bond. For the left-hand version, that's going to get us ethanol. Plus an unsaturated ketone. On the right-hand version, it's going to get us butene-al plus acetone. Questions about any of the problems we did? Yes? Actually, it's arbitrary because you'll lose stereochemistry once you attack. It's arbitrary actually only because we don't show the stereocenters which way they're configured. So I just happen to randomly one show cis or trans, but to know whether it's cis or trans, we'd have to know what the stereocenter was that was formed.
So we could randomly say, oh, this one is cis or that one is trans?
In this case, yes.